Tonight on the Daily Debrief, justice is delayed for three men accused of covering up a deadly shooting. And the U.S. Senate passes sweeping criminal justice reform. Also, ethics complaints get thrown out against Justice Brett Kavanaugh. Plus, this Walt Disney film is now part of a man's sentence. That's tonight on the Daily Debrief for Wednesday, December 19th. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Daily Debrief. Glad you're with us tonight. A verdict has been delayed in what we are calling the case of an alleged cop cover-up. It all surrounded what happened in this video, which shows Chicago police officer Jason Van Dyke shooting and killing a knife-wielding teenager named Laquan McDonald. One jury convicted Officer Van Dyke of second-degree murder and a series of related charges. However, that was not the end of the proceedings. Prosecutors accused three other officers of conspiracy, official misconduct, and obstruction of justice for their actions related to the case. Prosecutors say these men lied in their official reports by claiming Laquan McDonald attacked the officer who shot him or otherwise covered up the shooting. The officers chose a bench trial with a judge, no jury. The judge was supposed to deliver her verdict today, but didn't. She gave no explanation for the delay, but said she'd have the verdict ready on the morning of January 15th. Let's listen to some of the closing arguments, starting with the prosecution.
Defendant March falsely included McGilligan as a victim in order to support justification for the killing of Laquan McDonald. That's not supported by the video. Violating public trust, official misconduct, obstruction of justice, proved beyond a reasonable doubt, right in black and white. We're here because these officers and others tried to make the case against Van Dyke go away. Laquan McDonald was a human being. He deserved due process and the law, and not to have police officers write false reports and shape a false narrative to justify his killing. Filing a false police report in order to protect a fellow officer from prosecution is not honorable. It's not sticking up for a colleague. It's a violation of the public trust. It's a violation of their oath of office. It's a violation of the law. It's obstruction of justice. And agreeing together to violate the law in this way and taking an act in furtherance of that agreement is conspiracy. We wholeheartedly agree that being a police officer is a dangerous job. It's public service at its highest. We have the utmost respect for the thousands of police officers who serve and protect all of the people in this city. But along with that authority to serve and protect comes the responsibility as sworn officers to respect the law for all citizens.
The prosecution there was careful not to tarnish the reputations of other police officers that same office must work with to secure convictions in other cases. The defense for one of those officers, though, pushed back blame on victim Laquan McDonald.
I can't think of one law Laquan McDonald followed. And they don't address that, Judge. They don't talk about it, Judge. They don't talk about Laquan McDonald's crimes. They gloss over if they even mention that he had a knife. They completely ignore Rudy Barillas. They don't talk about him. They don't highlight his name on police reports. They refuse to accept that Officer Gaffney is a victim of an aggravated assault, a felony, a forcible felony. They refuse to accept that Officer McGilligan is following this armed offender for blocks. And he continuously asks, he demands, he pleads with McDonald to stop and drop the knife. McDonald ignores all of those commands. The prosecution doesn't want to talk about that. Well, the police officers out there that night, they can't afford to ignore it. This case isn't about violating public trust. It's about McDonald violating the laws. It's about law and order.
Joining me tonight on the Daily Debrief is juvenile court judge and fellow law and crime host Ashley Wilcott. Ashley, good to see you here
around the desk. Well, thank you. Thank you for letting me switch roles.
Okay. So this is an important decision for the people of Chicago. The judge has a couple of audiences here. The judge has to settle the matter herself. Okay, while presumably carrying on her own docket. Is that possibly why we have a delay in what was expected to be a verdict today?
Absolutely. So, Aaron, we may never know the reason. She may not say, absolutely, a judge has a full judge with a full-time job with the docket. And so for her to sit down and put pen to paper and deliberation about every single fact that she heard is a lot and requires a lot of time.
We've got three defendants here, three separate defenses. So she has a lot to worry about here. She has multiple audiences, the people of Chicago, an appeals court. The judge has to worry about that. The jury doesn't. Three defendants, three separate defenses. My guess is she just wants to be extra careful about everything.
I absolutely agree with you, and I suspect she's writing out the actual findings for the order, and that's very labor-intensive.
Exactly. So facts that apply to one defendant may not play any role with the case of another defendant.
Exactly right. So it's three separate cases that she actually has to work on three separate decisions.
It makes it easier for the appeals court, though, to look and say, okay, these are the findings of fact separate from the conclusions of law, because they have to go through that work.
Right. And it has to be separate, which people may not realize. And for her to do that, again, she's got to be the one to separate those. She was very diligent in taking notes. I suspect she'll be very diligent and deliberate in what she does.
And of course, we're saying appeals court, that assumes there's a conviction. There may be an acquittal. This may be a mixed verdict. We don't quite know.
That's right.
All right. Ashley Wilcott, we'll check in with you again at the end of the broadcast. Jury selection continues in a case we're planning to cover here on the Law and Crime Network. Jeremiah Monell of New Jersey is accused of stabbing his wife to death and leading police on a manhunt after the stabbing. Victim Tara O'Shea Watson died in December 2016. Jury selection began yesterday, but the trial will begin after the holidays. If convicted, Jeremiah Monell faces life without parole. He rejected a 30-year plea deal. The U.S. Senate has passed a sweeping criminal justice reform bill. The measure, which passed 87 to 12, follows a passing vote on a similar bill in the House of Representatives. The House is now expected to pass the Senate version of the bill, and President Donald Trump has said he will sign it. This rare moment of bipartisanship allows conservatives to save money by offering judges more leeway when sentencing nonviolent drug offenders. It also gives Democrats victory in moving defendants struggling with drug and mental health issues into treatment and away from prison. We're joined tonight by guest Gene Rossi. He's a former federal prosecutor who is currently a criminal defense attorney who appears regularly on the Law and Crime Network. Gene, good to see you.
Oh, good to see you, Aaron.
Okay, so what do you make of this thing? From your perspective, what does this accomplish? What does it not accomplish?
Well, here's what it does accomplish. It does give hope to hundreds of thousands of prisoners in the federal system, not the state, to get good time credit, number one, to possibly get their sentence reduced because the disparity between crack and cocaine is now reduced. And it also gives them education programs so that they can make that difficult transition from incarceration, confinement, to the community, because 95% of prisoners at the federal and state level eventually will get released. And the tragedy of America is this. We do not devote enough money and resources to help persons who are released from confinement to make that difficult transition to the community. And the bill is a good first step. What it doesn't do is this. It doesn't get rid of mandatory minimums, which I do think should be changed. I don't think we should handcuff judges on certain cases. And what it also doesn't do is it doesn't get rid of the three strikes law, which I do think is unfortunate. I had a defendant who got three strikes and he got life, and I eventually got it down to 30 years. And I think for some of those three strike situations, the three strikes are de minimis crimes for which you should not serve a mandatory life sentence. So that's the good and the bad.
Okay, so we talked about whether the bill was needed, what it's going to accomplish here. Some of the detractors, and I realize they were a minority, but they expressed concerns that, hey, look, if we're cutting back on sentences, it could create unsafe communities. What's your response to that criticism?
It's baloney. I was a federal prosecutor for almost 30 years. I did drug cases, organized crime cases for 20 in the U.S. Attorney's Office in Alexandria, Virginia. I supervised hundreds of prosecutors. And I can tell you this, addiction is a disease and mass incarceration is not the cure. And Senator Cotton of Arkansas and other senators don't get that. They think we're going to have jailbreaks because of this bill. We're going to have coveys and legions of prisoners going out to the community and committed robberies and rape and crimes. That's baloney. Many of those prisoners in the federal system and the state system have addiction issues, whether it's opioids, cocaine, crack, heroin. And if we don't attack the disease called addiction, we are never going to solve our crime crisis. So what I say to those people is they need to be a prosecutor like I was for almost 25, 30 years and see firsthand what some of these sentences do. And they don't do much.
So a question of the science and the law finally meeting up after there's been years and years of debate about this, whether addiction is a crime, a medical issue, or whatnot. I know that this is also going to influence some juvenile justice provisions. Do you know much about that, and can you explain?
Well, I wasn't able to read the fine print and the footnotes in the bill,
okay.
But I can say this. Any individual under 21 who is convicted of a serious felony, especially under 18, whether it's the state or federal system, we have to treat those individuals a lot differently than someone who's in their 40s or 50s and is still committing crimes. Mm-hmm. And any society has to address crimes committed by young adults because their minds are not fully developed. Teenagers, their minds are not fully developed. So any prison or criminal justice reform bill has to take that into account. And I got to end with this. I think it was Dostoevsky who said that the best way to judge a society is to go to their prisons, because how we treat prisoners is a judgment on us as a whole.
Look, it'll be interesting to see where this goes. Again, this affects federal prisoners. It'll be curious to see if this sort of spurs some more states into acting as well. Gene Rossi, former federal prosecutor, current criminal defense attorney, appreciate your opinions tonight on the Daily Debrief.
Thank you.
A bad breakup to report between Tinder and its former vice president of marketing, and it's ended with a lawsuit. Rosette Pakpihan claims she was sexually assaulted by former Match Group CEO Greg Blatt. Pakpihan says Blatt groped her and harassed her at a holiday party 2 years ago. She also claims the company retaliated against her by failing to fully investigate her claim and then firing her the day she filed her lawsuit. Other founding members of Tinder are also joining the dispute, which also involves questions about the company's value. The company calls the lawsuit meritless. The newest member of the U.S. Supreme Court appears to be out of legal trouble despite a contentious Senate confirmation. A panel of federal judges dropped more than 80 ethics complaints filed against Justice Brett Kavanaugh. The complaints varied but included claims that Kavanaugh misled the Senate about some of his activities during his time working for President George W. Bush. Most of the complaints involved Kavanaugh's questionable behavior during his September confirmation hearings. A look now at some of Kavanaugh's answers back then.
As no doubt was expected, if not planned, came a long series of false last-minute smears designed to scare me and drive me out of the process before any hearing occurred. Crazy stuff. Gangs, illegitimate children, fights on boats in Rhode Island, all nonsense reported breathlessly and often uncritically by the media. This has destroyed my family and my good name, a good name built up through decades of very hard work and public service at the highest levels of the American government. This whole two-week effort has been a calculated and orchestrated political hit, fueled with apparent pent-up anger about President Trump and the 2016 election, fear that has been unfairly stoked about my judicial record, revenge on behalf of the Clintons, and millions of dollars in money from outside left-wing opposition groups. This is a circus. The consequences will extend long past my nomination. The consequences will be with us for decades.
Those words from Justice Brett Kavanaugh during his confirmation. Yet another twist in Special Counsel Robert Mueller's probe into Russian involvement in the 2016 election. A U.S. Court of Appeals document revealed that a mystery appellant who resisted one of Mueller's grand jury subpoenas is not a person. It's a company based in a still unnamed foreign country. The filing states that the company cannot respond to the subpoena because doing so would be a violation of the laws of that other country. It's unclear whether the company in question is based in Russia, but Mueller's team is, after all, investigating potential Russian interference in U.S. politics. A judge has struck down an attempt by a civil rights group to gain access to President Donald Trump's income tax returns. A request by the Electronic Privacy Information Center to see President Trump's tax returns for the years after 2010 has thus ended in defeat. The group sought Trump's tax information through an open records request. The judge ruled that no one can demand to inspect another's tax records, especially through that law. Still ahead tonight on the Daily Debrief, a Walt Disney film is apparently part of the punishment for one Missouri defendant. We'll explain that. Plus, an embarrassing moment caught on an officer's body camera shows a sheriff on the other side of the law. Find out what he's accused of doing. That's next when we return on the Debrief. Welcome back, folks. Let's go straight to Anthony Velez now with other criminal incidents in the news.
Here are today's top crime stories trending on LawAndCrime.com and across the country. Authorities in Texas released surveillance footage of the heroic moments two deputies pulled a man from a burning car, saving his life. The incident happened near Winnie, 60 miles east of Houston, where the unidentified man's vehicle caught fire after crashing. Officers snapped into action, dragging the unconscious man from the vehicle, utilizing a puddle to put out his burning clothes. The man was taken into a hospital and remains in critical condition.
And he's on death row because he asked Gloria Gomez to take her shoes off.
The sister-in-law of infamous killer Scott Peterson, the man famously convicted for the 2002 killing of his wife Lacey and their unborn child Connor, says the evidence proves Peterson is innocent. Peterson's sister-in-law, Janie Peterson, went on Dr. Phil stating Scott was wrongfully convicted.
Scott has been wrongfully convicted of murdering his wife and son.
Peterson is currently on death row at San Quentin State Prison in Marin County, California, and is awaiting his appeal, which is still pending. Police in New York City arrested the woman accused of slashing two other women for trying to pet her dog. The suspect, 38-year-old Shakima Young, is accused of slashing two women on a bus in the Melrose section of the Bronx for reportedly trying to pet her service dog. Both victims suffered slash wounds before running to a nearby hospital for medical assistance. Young now faces multiple charges, including felony assault.
Try to help me out, man. I can't go to jail for
A sheriff in Michigan accused of drunk driving was caught on body camera footage trying to use his status as a law enforcement officer to evade arrest. Midland County Sheriff Scott Stevenson was arrested in November after deputies responded to a call of a passed out motorist on the side of the road. Stevenson reportedly scored a 0.23% blood alcohol level, nearly three times Michigan's legal limit, and appeared severely impaired.
Listen, I don't know who you are.
I'm Midland County Sheriff. I'm good. I had a bad day.
Stevenson was arrested and eventually pleaded guilty to operating a motor vehicle while visibly impaired. Those were today's top crime stories. I'm Anthony Velez for the Daily Debrief.
Judge Ashley Wilcott is with us tonight. So, Judge, look, I don't know what it is in your state, but in states where I'm used to working, you know, why didn't he take the keys out of the ignition and sit in the back seat? Then he wouldn't have been in actual physical control, and he probably would have been able to beat the rap on this. But 0.233.
Yeah, that's
analysis.
Crazy. Yeah, that's a lot of drinking, right? And I would just say this. I even made the comment, hey, at least he was on the side of the road and he wasn't driving, probably because he couldn't physically drive because of his alcohol blood level. You know what? It doesn't matter what kind of position you have. If you drink too much, you end up in this situation. Regardless of who he is, he's got to, you know, pay the consequences.
So I know that you deal with juvenile court, but how would you deal with it if you had a guy like this, who's a constitutional officer, as we hear him saying in the recording, who winds up in front of you accused of breaking the law?
Well, A, no differently than any other defendant, other than I would certainly keep in mind it needs to be a deterrent and a lesson and a public statement of that's even more of a reason is you've got to uphold the laws. You can't break them because you're in the position of actually arresting people for violations of those same laws.
Does it mean a tougher sentence for someone like him?
It could, absolutely. That could be an aggravating circumstance.
Depends on how things roll. Okay, let's move on to one last story tonight. A Missouri sentence is catching attention nationwide for its creativity and some would argue its constitutionality. David Berry Jr. pleaded guilty to a misdemeanor charge of taking wildlife illegally. Basically, here's what that means. Prosecutors say he was involved with a poaching scheme which killed hundreds of deer, sometimes removing only the animals' heads as trophies and leaving the bodies to waste. The sentence, 1 year in jail, which the judge originally suspended in return for 2 years of probation. When David Berry violated his probation by shooting more animals, the judge ordered him to jail and something else. The judge is requiring Berry to watch Bambi once a month, especially the scene where the hunter kills Bambi's mother. The first screening, the judge said, must take place just before Christmas. Judge Wilcott, what do you make of this sentence?
Well, it's unique, right? I think it's every effort the judge can make to say, I want you to recognize how bad this is and feel some compassion for what you're doing, especially if you're disposing of the body and not even using it to feed people.
I will admit I had to go back and watch that scene from Bambi. I think we're going to take a look at it now where, you know, the color scheme gets very somber after the mother and Bambi are trying to eat the grass. And then it turns into this drawn-out chase scene. And then we're left with a conclusion that Bambi's mother is shot. Of course, it's a Disney film, and the graphic detail is spared from the audience here. But does this have enough psychological meaning to punish someone who's already out shooting hundreds of deers and just taking the heads and leaving the bodies?
I'm not sure if it's meant to punish Aaron or if it's meant to see, hey, can we actually get this man to have some compassion by seeing it in this setting and say, I'm not going to do it anymore because now I feel bad about doing it. I don't think that's going to be effective, but I think that's one of the goals.
Should we expect to hear an argument about this being some cruel and unusual punishment here? Because it's not cruel or unusual punishment. Does it need to be cruel and also unusual? And it is this cruel.
Well, he may argue it's cruel to him because of his mental capacity or how it affects him mentally. I think that they might argue it's especially unusual. I don't buy it, but I think any defense attorney could make a valid argument.
Okay. I mean, I'll be curious to see if we get that. Would you have passed down that sentence?
I would not have thought of passing down that sentence, to be honest.
Not creative enough.
Not creative enough for that one.
Look, Judge, next time you're here on Law and Crime, we'll have to review our filmography of movies that may carry lessons. I'm sure that'll give us plenty to talk about rather next time.
Absolutely.
All right, Judge Wilcott, we always appreciate your expertise here on The Debrief.
Thank you for having me.
And a reminder, folks, that our live coverage of trials around the country and hearings and whatnot, legal news of the day begins starting live at 9 o'clock in the morning. We're live from 9 to 5 on the Law and Crime Network. Plus, I'll see you here on The Daily Debrief starting from 5 o'clock until 5:30. From all of us here at the Law and Crime Network, have a good evening, and we'll see you back here tomorrow night.